Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. With 4 days to go before a midterm election that could mean big changes in Washington, or maybe just more of the same, we live in a nation that seems to be questioning itself. Sometimes we hear that democracy is failing, or that it never worked for everyone. But is it? And how do we get back to being a nation that may disagree but works together for our common goals? Democracy is at the forefront of a project at Penn State University. Joining us on today's program is Dr. Michael Berkman, director, Dr. Christopher Beam, managing director, and Jenna Spinelli, communications specialist, all at the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State University. Welcome to the program. Okay, if I hit the right channel, there we go. Can you hear me now?
We can hear you.
I was hoping that you were signing or something like that. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Michael Berkman, how would you describe the McCourtney Institute for Democracy?
Hi, Scott. Thank you. The McCourtney Institute for Democracy has three pieces to its mission, all revolving around promoting and studying democracy, both in the United States and abroad. We have an outreach mission where we try to speak to the broader public about issues around democracy. We have an educational mission where we work with our students on democracy. And we have a research function where we promote research on democracy in both the social sciences and the humanities.
Now, when you say studying democracy, I mean, here in the United States, democracy has been around for over 230 years. Mm-hmm. What about democracy needs studying? Now, I'm just talking about the United States.
Well, there are all kinds of aspects to democracy to study. On the humanities side, we focus on rhetoric and how people deliberate, how they talk about issues, how they talk about democracy. On the social science side of the McCourtney Institute, we run a poll called the Mood of the Nation poll, where we use a unique open-ended polling instrument to talk to Americans about how they feel about politics today, what they're angry about, what they're hopeful about, what they're proud of, and what they're worried about.
And what are we talking about that you mentioned that the Mood of the Nation poll? During the course of our conversation, I want to bring that up and talk about the Mood of the Nation, because you just conducted one in early October. I should say the results were released in early October.
Right.
Dr. Beam, let me bring you into the conversation here. Partisans for Democracy, what does that mean?
Well, it means that we strive to stay above the kind of partisan bickering or back and forth that you hear. And we strive not to take positions on just policy issues. However, democracy, we feel, needs defending and deserves to be defended. And so when things come up that we think are negative or undermine democracy, we want to stick up for them. So that's what it means. I mean, we also feel that partisanship gets something of a bad rap, right? That, you know, people say, well, we need to get partisanship out of it. And we don't think that's true. Fighting is just inevitable in a free society.
Well,
people are not going to agree.
Conflict's built into the system.
Right, exactly.
It is
an adversarial system, and people are not going to agree, right? But the point is, how do we disagree, and how do we engage each other? And so you can be a partisan, and you should be a partisan. You should stick up for what you believe, but you need to do it in a way that is forthright, truthful, self-critical, and also respectful of the other side.
You know, in my introduction, and I have to admit that some of my language was taken directly from your website. You probably recognize that language,
mm-hmm.
But I'll give you credit. Oh. So I'm not stealing or anything like that. Anyway, but one of the things that you do say in there is that you often hear people today talk about democracy failing. What do you hear? I mean, we hear it all the time, but not very often do you have people come out and say, our democracy is failing, it's not working anymore. How would you describe what you hear when you hear people say democracy is failing?
Well, there's a couple of ways to go with that. First of all, just worldwide, there is a fairly clear, documented decline in the number of democracies in the world and the condition of civil rights and freedom in the world.
And press freedoms.
Right. And so you see countries, in just about every continent, Venezuela, Western Europe, Poland.
Recent elections in Brazil.
Right. I mean, so around the world, there is democracy is not doing as well as it was, say, 10 years ago. The other thing is that here in America, you see just a decline, especially among young people, in their beliefs in democracy and their respect for it as a way of ordering society. And, you know, let's face it, for students that we, you know, teach at Penn State, there's a good reason for them to feel that way. They haven't seen anything but a very unproductive and contentious climate. And they look at democracy and they say, well, it doesn't accomplish anything. So you there's a lot of reasons why people are concerned about the condition of democracy and why we feel like our job is to say, look, just because it's not working mm-hmm. right now doesn't mean it doesn't work.
Right. And there's also much to be hopeful about in politics. I mean, we are seeing, and many of the guests on our show comment about sort of the increase in civic engagement that they see. They look at large protests as a good sign, as a part of a healthy democracy. And we agree with that. There's interest in democracy. The failing New York Times hasn't been doing better in quite a long time. The Washington Post is doing great. Old-time magazines like The Atlantic are running terrifically interesting issues on democracy. People are reading them. When we had David Frum on campus the other day, and he talked about, and we've noticed this as well, that people are not only buying more books about democracy, they're really engaged in these books.
They're reading them.
They're reading them. That's what he commented on that really seemed to surprise him. He said, I'm not only selling books, but people seem to be reading them when I talk to them. And we had a full house David Frum came to speak. So there are things to be concerned about, but there are things to be hopeful about.
A couple of things, Dr. Berkman. When you said the failing New York Times, I assume you're being sarcastic there.
I am. I'm
sorry.
I forget that irony doesn't always work.
Nowadays, though, someone who hosts a daily talk show, I have found that even when you're, being sarcastic or being throwing some humor in there, that there are people. And I think it's an example of our polarization that, Scott Lamar said this, Michael Berkman said this. But anyway, I wanted
people's
to point that
emotions
out.
Are raw. I get that. Mm-hmm.
But let me go a step further with that in something that you talked about, and you talked about press freedom. And this is one of the areas, obviously, that's near and dear to me as someone in the media, but it's very, very noticeable for every American out there that the media is under attack now. I can't make comparisons to 50, 100 years ago, but in my lifetime, the media is under attack now or being criticized, being questioned, their credibility being questioned like never before. Is freedom of the press, which is a big part of democracy, is it in jeopardy?
Yeah, so this is Jenna. I teach in our journalism school at Penn State, and this is a conversation that I have, and I know that my colleagues in our communications program have as well with our students. And I think that that certainly is one way to look at it, that freedom of the press is on the decline. But I mean, what I'm seeing is that there's also never perhaps been a better time to be a journalist. There are the Times and the Post and organizations around the country are hiring more reporters than they have in a long time. There are lots of new ways that people are finding to tell stories and get the news out. We early on in our podcast, we interviewed the editor of a site in Pittsburgh called Public Source, which is a nonprofit journalism model. We had the head of the Knight Foundation on campus a couple of weeks ago. I got to talk with him about lots of other things that foundation is doing to support the work of journalism. journalists across the country. So I tend to be an optimist by nature. I think I balance out Chris and Michael in that regard sometimes. But
she tries anyway.
I think the issue, Scott, is not so much the freedom of the press here, but the disparagement of the press to the extent to which it's become extremely partisan. And one thing that shows up in our polling pretty consistently is that Republicans in particular have really adopted this sort of anger and distrust of the press. We hear it all the time. And that becomes problematic because you need to have some arbitrators of truth and what's going on out there in order for us to have reasonable discussions about what to do about things. Mm. It also concerns us that many of these sorts of attacks on the press have been picked up by authoritarians in other countries where it can really translate to much more dangerous outcomes. And of course, we're speaking in the aftermath of the horrific murder of a journalist in an embassy in Turkey.
Well, I've even noticed here on the local level that, mm-hmm. you know, in this election cycle, for example, candidates that don't want to talk to the media or
right.
candidates mm-hmm. that don't like a story that will refer to it as fake news. So it's even made
exactly.
its way down to the local level. Now, you mentioned
You're
your
right
program.
About that.
And one of the things that we wanted to do this program today is because you have a new podcast called Democracy Works. And mm-hmm. I just want to play a snippet of a podcast where you are talking about polarization. Now, this is about a minute and a half, but just listen. This is part of Democracy Works.
And Michael, we're going to talk today about polarization. Mm-hmm. And there is nobody, I don't think, who would dispute the idea that ours is a very polarized politics and culture. But it would be useful for us to just take a step back and talk about what does that mean? And what are the implications of that for democracy? So Michael, what does it mean? What does polarization mean?
Right. So this is a term we hear a lot about, and it's not always clear to me that it's being used quite properly. It's useful when thinking about polarization to kind of divide the political world into two distinct groups, and that is elites, you know, elected officials, mm-hmm. and the public. And often polarization is used to apply to one, to apply to the other, to apply to both, and it's useful to kind of to sort that out a little bit. There's no doubt in this country that political elites have become highly polarized. Now, what that means is that the Democratic and Republican Party have become much more ideologically distinct mm-hmm. from one another. But it's also important to note, and commentators often don't like to acknowledge this, that polarization is what we call asymmetrical. And what asymmetrical polarization refers to is that the fact that the Republican Party elites have become far more conservative over time than Democratic elites have become liberal mm-hmm, over time. Mm-hmm. The consequence of that is polarization.
So you get to hear yourself there.
And I stand by it.
but you know, one thing I will add, though, when you say that Democracy Works, the podcast, and mm-hmm. that the McCourtney Institute for Democracy is nonpartisan, you know, that statement at the end that Republicans have become more partisan in mm-hmm. our polarized society, they probably will hear that and say, see, this is what the liberals think about us, that we are more polarized, that we're more polarizing than they are.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I respond to a question like that. Well, I respond to what Chris was saying about polarization as a political scientist. And this is what the data tell us. The fact is that especially when you're looking at data on congressional voting over a very long period
over
of time.
Decades.
Yeah, this goes back to the 1960s, that the Republican Party fairly rapidly and dramatically and continuously has become more conservative. Now, there are a lot of reasons for this. Mm-hmm. The abandonment of Democrats in the South or in much of the South to the Republican Party. Later on, the Tea Party movement, all of these things have sort of pushed the party to the right more dramatically than the Democrats have pushed to the left. Now, I get that that might be received by some as kind of a partisan statement, but I really stand by it as an empirical statement.
Well, again, the reason I bring it up is because it's an example of how polarized we are, that don't dare say anything negative about one or the other without getting a response. That, see, it's that whataboutism. That, well, what about this? If you bring something up and say, well, Republicans are have become more partisan, I guarantee you can find Republicans out there right now and say, well, what about the left that or the Democrats that keep moving further to the left?
Right. And I mean, that whole kind of mentality is, I think, what we were trying to get away from when we started our podcast, trying to, you know, maybe take a deeper dive into some of these issues to get away from that sense of whataboutism and really try to understand what's at the heart of some of these issues that we hear about so much.
Well, and by the way, I would agree with the idea that the Democratic Party will now probably start moving more to the left. And what I'm talking about is the historic pattern over many decades. But I think we're seeing some of that in the Democratic Party. But the fact is, the Democratic Party has not had a Tea Party moment in the way that the Republican Party has, by which I mean these sort of challenges coming from the more extreme wings of the party that become really decisive in shaping the direction of the party. But I get your main point here. It's not as Jenna says, that's something we were trying to kind of get away from.
And we're going to talk more about, we got a whole lot more to talk about. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guests today are from the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State University. We're talking about that. We will be talking about and talk a little more about their new podcast called Democracy Works. Joining us, Dr. Michael Berkman, who is the director, Dr. Christopher Beam, the managing director, and Jenna Spinelli, who is the communication specialist, all at the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State University. I see that we have some very, very busy phones right now, so we'll get to some phone calls in just a moment. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. And if you would like to go on WITF's Facebook page, you can do that. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Ken in New Oxford. Ken, you're on the air.
Yes, I would like to know why in America only 40% of the people seem to vote, and how can we consider that healthy for democracy?
Thank you very much for your call. We hear that often about if we're going to be a democracy, that we have to get people to participate in the process.
Right. And there are other countries that I think Australia actually fines you.
Right, it's mandatory to vote in Australia.
Yeah, and so there are other models. I mean, the argument is that, or the counter argument, I guess, is that if in a free society, part of being free is being able to choose not to care. Now, I mean, that is a problem, but it's also it's hard to say anything more than it's both your duty and your self-interest to vote. But, more than that, in a free society, I think it's hard to do.
Well, we could also make voting easier. And I would agree with you that with the caller that that's a low number and we should shoot for a higher number. And, personally, I think voting should occur on a national holiday. I think that voting should just be made easier and more accessible. And because it can be difficult for some people to vote. And, you should be committed to it enough that you overcome obstacles that are there. But still, it's true. It could be easier. It could be more accessible. But voting in this country, remember, elections are run by the states. We have 50 different elections that are going on every time under different kinds of rules and regulations. And it's a real patchwork. In some states, voting is higher. In some states, voting is lower.
Yeah, that's all true.
And to that end, I think in the McCourtney Institute, we've been involved with efforts to try to, increase voter registration on campus and, throughout the Penn State community. So we're definitely kind of aware of that, too, and trying to do what we can to help that as well.
Yeah. When you say that the Institute is there to defend democracy, is this one of the areas that needs defended, that we need more participation?
I think what needs defending is the idea that democracy is not easy, right? It's not natural. I mean, your right. natural inclination is to get into your tribal identities and to fight and to hate the other side, right? I mean, that there is some kind of basic fundamental features of human beings that push us in that direction. Democracy says fight, but be civil about it. Fight, but don't see your opponent as an enemy. And so when we're defending democracy, that's what we're trying to defend, is the fact that it's not simple or natural or easy. It takes work. Thus the name Democracy Works.
Mm. And that's the podcast. Jenna, let me ask you, how did the podcast come about?
Yeah, so about a year ago at this time, Chris and Michael and I were in the car on the way to an event in Washington, D.C. Two things happened on that trip. One was that we listened to a lot of podcasts. The other is that I spent a lot of time listening to Chris and Michael talk, much in the same way you heard them talk in the clip that you played. So we realized, I think, pretty quickly that their kind of knowledge and expertise and their natural rapport that they have would lend itself well, and then my kind of journalism background would be a good fit to do interviews. So we are really lucky to work with WPSU here in State College. They really helped us take the show from an idea and something we talked about into something that's actually on the air in pretty quick time as far as higher ed standards go. We tend not to move very quickly in our community. So, you know, the fact that we've been able to do, I think it's 35 episodes just since March of this year is, I think, a testament to, one, how much need and, you know, how much of an opportunity there is to have these conversations about democracy, and just to the partnerships we've been able to form in our community here on campus.
Are people listening?
I just want to add, we're really kind of, I mean, somewhere between surprised and shocked at how quickly people responded to this.
Yeah.
You know, we really figured, well, we'll get some folks from Penn State. But, I mean, we're in 49 states and how many countries?
88 countries.
Yeah, 88 countries. And we never
expected
that.
But none in China.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Where we believe we're banned.
We're banned, right.
Oh, really?
But so the point is just that I don't think, you know, it necessarily has to do with how smart we are, but how hungry people are for this kind of approach to these issues in a more thoughtful and deliberative way.
Mm-hmm. And podcasting is a great medium for doing that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Let's take some more phone calls. John is in Dauphin. John, you're on the air.
Thank you, Scott. Just a question. I know we live in the United States in a representative democracy. I wonder if the guests have studied true democracies and how they might change as technology allows us to get closer to letting the people actually vote on individual issues.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. I knew this question was going to come up, gentlemen and Jenna.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know. So there's a couple things. We actually invest a lot of effort in a kind of democracy called deliberative or participatory democracy. Mm-hmm. We have a very well-regarded program for students to intern in organizations that practice this. We have a class that teaches it.
And we've recognized it with our Brown Democracy
Medal.
We give out a medal every year for innovations in democracy and people that are doing exceptional work in democracy, and have recognized participatory budgeting, which does a form of this.
Right. Go ahead.
Spoiler alert, you can hear all about some of these things in upcoming podcast episodes.
That's right.
But is that one of those shameless plugs, you know, Jenna?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And by the way, we have a link on our website, WITF.org, to the Democracy Works, actually to the Institute, and then also to Democracy Works podcast. So go ahead. What were we going to say?
Mm-hmm. Well, this argument that we're not really a democracy, we're a republic, and I push back on that a lot. A republic is, you know, whatever distinctions there are about the kind of democracy we have, you know. Abraham Lincoln said, of the people, by the people, for the people. Sovereignty is how you define a political system. And in the United States, the people are the sovereigns. This is a democracy. And the fact that we represent, that we vote for representatives does not in any way change the that fundamental reality.
Yes, all true. Although, you know, you read the framers and it's obvious that they also were concerned about too much democracy. And so one thing that they were trying to accomplish in how they designed government was to moderate democracy to a certain extent. And so they recognized a tension between the necessity of having the people be sovereign, of having people participate, and having excessive democracy, which they had seen both in states and in ancient Greece as being too much democracy.
You know, and let me just bring this up, because one of the things that I hear here in Pennsylvania when we're talking about how the system can be improved is that there would be more ballot questions. There would be more voter participation, that voters could directly vote on an issue. They always point to California as where initiatives are on the ballot all the time. Now, I also have heard from the other side that it would be chaos here, that the ballots would be long, that people wouldn't understand unless you went into a lot of depth and context about the questions. So let's bring that into it, because I think that's one of the things that the caller was bringing up, that more democracy or true democracy would be where people wouldn't have to go through a representative, but could vote on these issues, decide on these issues in person by themselves.
Right. And certainly you see that more at the local level, where certain kinds of school budget issues or referendums have school budget issues or capital expenses have to be have to go through referendums of different types. At the statewide level, you know, I think California should not necessarily be held up as a model of a great way to run elections. The ballots are huge. The issues are complex. There is all kinds of big money behind these ballot initiatives. There's a lot that's actually not very democratic about them. You know, I remember on a very recent Pennsylvania election, there was a referendum issue about when judges needed to retire. I don't know if you remember this, but it had to do with essentially raising the age to 75 from 70. But the ballot initiative was written in such a way that whenever I show it to students anyway, they think it was that it was moving from a system where judges may have had lifetime tenure down. And my point in this, I don't know if you remember that, is that these things can be very confusing. And one reason that the framers believed strongly in representative democracy was that they thought representatives would actually do a better job than the public could do in working through complex kinds of issues.
Okay, so I just want to step in here and give us another shameless plug. We have an upcoming
episode
The Citizen Initiative Review that is an example of this kind of participatory democracy actually in Oregon.
Right.
And our colleague John Gastel has studied this for years. And yeah, I think both Michael and I and Jenna all come down the same spot with this, that that you know, there are problems with the initiative, not from the from the standpoint of partisanship, but from the standpoint of how a democracy ought to run and how and why a representative democracy works better.
Right, and then you know, kind of bringing it all back to that, doing the hard work of democracy. I mean, I think it says something in and of itself that there are these groups out there trying to figure out how to tackle some of these problems.
That's right.
Have they found the perfect way to do it? Maybe not, but you know, they're certainly still trying to figure it out and see what works best.
Let's take a call from Bill in Elliottsburg. Bill, you're on the air.
Good morning, Scott. When I think of democracy, there's a lot to unpack here. But sometimes the thought occurred to me this morning about social media, and especially in lieu of that horrible events up in Pittsburgh, where that gentleman belonged to some group that was on the web. And I've been hearing lately about this thing called the dark web, and I'm totally unfamiliar with it. But my general point about that is that, you know, social media can bring big people together, and it can isolate people. And sometimes I think back in the 2016 election, some of the preposterous political ads I was coming across my Facebook, which I think they're trying to fix, were absolutely ridiculous. But yet I think a lot of Americans buy into it. And I can't help but think that this sort of the thing that happened, this social media, like I said, it can join people and it can explode people. And I think we have a gentleman in the White House whose rhetoric plays into this sort of the divisiveness. The other thing I wanted to say is, like me and my dad's 87, and we talk about statesmanship. And it seems, in part, that our representatives are afraid to reach across the aisle and shake each other's hands or come to a deal for the that's going to benefit the majority of the people. And let me just close with this, that, and I always, you know, no matter what happens as we slog through this mark politics or otherwise, I think it was Martin Luther King had said at one time, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. So I'm going to hang up and listen to your comments.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your call. He brought up a lot there. Who wants to tackle that?
Well, let me take on this social media issue, because part of what he was saying, which was quite well put, reminds me of Mark Zuckerberg talking about his surprise that Facebook was going to be used for nefarious purposes, because he just didn't really imagine that that was going to be the case. And we had a really interesting discussion a few weeks ago with somebody in D.C. about Russian interference in particular, and how they use social media and how they're able to use social media to build upon divisions that already exist in American society and sow deeper division and sow deeper conflict. And we know we saw that in the 2016 election. We're seeing it all the time. We're seeing it right now. We're going to continue to see it into the future. We've done some different episodes on social media. It is tough to get a handle on. It perplexes media scholars, political scientists, and everybody right now about how you deal with this new way of communicating that is both incredibly open to some of the darkest elements of our society, but also does allow people to connect.
You know, I just want to jump in here. When David Frum was talking to us, he talked about social media, and it's a tool, right? And it is just a fact that people can use social media to organize in a way that is just astonishing, right? The Parkland kids in 3 months went from nothing to 1,000 events throughout the world, right? And this is impossible without social media.
But David Frum also had something very interesting to say, especially talking to students. And he was saying to them, get off social media and join something. It doesn't even have to be a political group. And I think this speaks to the last part of the caller's question, too. Get into something where you have to interact with other people, where you have to work together to get something done, where you have to maybe work with people you don't know a lot about or you don't necessarily agree with, because that really is, too, part of democracy.
Right.
And that the face-to-face is important. And we all know, our students in particular, every generation younger is more and more onto social media in different kinds of ways. And I thought David Frum's advice
there
was really
right.
Important.
I was actually thinking about my experience as a Little League coach, and it was exactly right. It's just, you know, these people that you don't disagree with, you don't agree with, and who you would never have any interactions with otherwise, you come to see them not as these faceless things that you can hand.
Or somebody making a comment on Facebook.
Yeah, and so there's something profoundly isolative and mean about social media that it's just impossible when you're dealing with flesh and blood human beings.
And the business model of social media, it can be concerning because, you need links and you need clicks. And so therefore, anything that will generate a click is often put out there.
We're almost out of time. I want to thank the three of you very much for being with us and raised so many really questions to think about. And I would encourage everyone listening today to go to Democracy Works, your new podcast, from the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State University, Dr. Michael Berkman, Dr. Christopher Beam, and Jenna Spinelli. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having us, Scott. It was fun.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on Monday, Smart Talk, open enrollment for health insurance exchanges began yesterday. We'll talk with Pennsylvania's Insurance Commissioner, Jessica Altman. Our final candidate conversation we have this month is with Dale Kearns, a libertarian who is running for the U.S. Senate. Mr. Kearns, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
And for those of the voters out there who are not familiar with Dale Kearns, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm an activist turned politician, and I hate to use that word, but now that I've been campaigning for a year and a half, I've come to grips with it. I'm a politician, but I'm not like the others. I've never been in Washington, D.C. before, never had to deal with the swamp, so to speak, and I'm a father, I'm a husband, I'm a project manager. I work 60 hours a week, and I campaign for, let's say, 40 or 50 hours a week, but I do it a little differently. I don't sit at $1,000 plate dinners. I get out there in the community, knock on doors, hold town halls. I've actually held 20 town halls in the last year and a half, and the entire time my opponents have been in office, together they have not held 20 town halls if you add them up. So I'm a lot different. I'm a man of the people. I believe in free markets. I believe in the Constitution. And I don't believe that we need to compromise principles in order to compromise in Washington, D.C.
Why are you running?
I'm running because I have two little girls. I have a wife. I don't want them to go through the struggles that we have all gone through over the years. I don't want to continue to kick the can down the road with our deficit, with our debt, and with all the issues that we're speaking about. If you look at any of the hot-button issues in today's politics, they're the same issues we had in the 70s virtually. The only difference is might be technology or the different players that are involved. But the same issues are often talked about and thrown around. It's political rhetoric just in time for the midterms. And I think enough is enough. I think people are tired of it. And as someone who would go to Washington, D.C., I promise not to take a pension, not to take the health care, and not to run for a second term, because I believe that we should go there, get the job done, and go home. And being that the Senate is split around 49-50, and when I get there, it would be 49-50-1, I'll be the most sought-after senator to where I can get something done on all the issues. So when each party's hugging the party line, because that's what they do, it's all rhetoric, and they've hugged the party line, I'll be the deciding vote. I'm going to be the most sought-after senator so I can get something done for Pennsylvanians.
Well, let's talk about that. You are a libertarian, and I should add, I just heard you cough, that you're not filling up a little bit under the weather today. You were going to be here, but I'm glad to hear that you have some voice today. But as a libertarian, why running as a libertarian rather than as a Republican or a Democrat?
When you run as a Republican or Democrat, you're controlled by the two-party system. If I talk about things that they don't want me to talk about, then they're going to push me to the side. They're going to make sure I don't get the money that I need to win. They're going to make sure that they don't push my agenda at the polls because it's not their agenda. But I'm here to push the agenda of the people, the agenda of everyone, rather than just the two-party system, because my goal is not to put more R's on the ballot or more D's on the ballot. It's to put more people in office that have principles and that are going to get a job done for the people.
But, you know, let's talk about it realistically, though. When you talk about money, let's face it, Republicans and Democrats have so much more money than anyone who is an independent, a libertarian, you know, running for another party. How do you win?
Oh, well, you win by getting out there with the people that actually vote, rather than the donors and the lobbyists that control the bills and control Washington, D.C. They don't want my message heard, and that's fine. So I get out there with the people. I've raised more than any other third-party candidate out there or independent, other than Gary Johnson in New Mexico. I've raised $280,000 during this campaign, and I've spent every penny of it. When you look into the old parties, they still have a lot of money sitting in their campaign coffers. Bob Casey, for instance, he's sitting on like $18 million. When you raise $18 million, actually he's raised over $20 million. When you raise that much for a position that pays $170,000, I'd say that means he's out of touch with Pennsylvanians. I'd say the fact that he's having $1,000 plate dinners and all these big fundraisers, rather than getting out there and holding town halls and getting out there and dealing with the people, same thing with Lou Barletta. When they're doing this, they show that they don't care about the people as much as they care about putting more in their campaign coffers.
All right, let's talk about some issues. Looking at where you stand on some of the issues, want to bring them up and have you talk about them. One of the things that you mentioned is that you would like to abolish the IRS and eliminate federal income taxes. Why?
Well, I think it's immoral that we allow the federal government to collect our wages and say that they own our wages. The way we own our labor, we should be able to produce as much as we want, and that actually grows the economy. And if we're growing the economy because we're putting more people to work and encouraging more people to work, then I think that's better off. What we'll do is we'll have right now we have a great economy. So if we're putting more people to work and they have more of an incentive to earn more, the economy bubble that we have is going to last a lot longer. We're not going to have these big dips and dives in the economy, and we're going to be more prosperous. It's just immoral when you think about it that someone could own your labor. The fact that someone thought that was a good idea is beyond me. Back in, I believe it was like 1890, the Supreme Court actually ruled that the income tax was unconstitutional.
But how do you pay for the government, though? Because let's face it, even if you want to shrink government, there is a need for it, whether it's for a military, for protection, for those who may be down on their luck, not working, have medical problems. You know, there's so many things I could list, but how do you pay for government?
Well, most of our... First of all, we have a lot of spending in government. The government's bloated. We need to get rid of the waste. And if you look at the numbers based on waste and the personal income tax, most of the things that are paid through government don't come from the personal income tax. The personal income tax is just there to collect money for a private agency, which is the IRS, which happened to get passed at the same time as the Federal Reserve, which is a private bank. And they work hand in hand with keeping poor people down, causing prices to go up. We could do something different, like a consumption tax. A consumption tax would be more fair. It would encourage people to work. It would also make our government be more accountable for the spending that they have. So if we go line item by line item with the federal government, we can cut so much out. We can get back to like 2006 levels and really save this government from failing. Because one day we will fail. The chickens will come home to roost. We're $21 trillion in debt. We need to change what we're doing.
Yeah, but I just want to clarify this. Are you suggesting that there's a conspiracy between the IRS and the Fed?
Oh, there absolutely is. The Federal Reserve and the IRS, they're involved 100% as a private banking and a private agency. The IRS virtually pays for the Federal Reserve, and it helps prop up the Federal Reserve.
And is this a nefarious kind of conspiracy?
No, it's not a conspiracy whatsoever. It's a fact of the matter. It's a matter of fact, I should say. And the Federal Reserve has been in place since 1913, just like the IRS. They were both put in about the same time, and one feeds the other.
You said replace it with the income tax with a consumption tax. What is a consumption tax? How would that work?
When you go to purchase goods and services, there would be a tax on that, and that's how we would. You can actually go to the store, you can go wherever you're going, and you can decide whether or not you're going to pay taxes. It makes it more voluntary for people.
So, in other words, a sales tax.
Essentially.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let me move on to some other issues. You would like to see Roe versus Wade overturned, correct?
Correct. I don't think that the federal government has a role in abortion. I think that the federal government should be hands-off. Personally, I'm pro-life. I believe that abortion is immoral, and I don't advocate for abortion at all. However, I don't think that we should pass a federal law that says that we should abolish abortion. I think that that's something that's left up to the states. I believe that I have a daughter, two daughters, a wife, and I would never try to force my views on them or try to tell them what to do when they're in that situation, but I would try to educate them. I would try to make sure they know exactly what an abortion is, exactly what happens. I would try to make sure that they could exhaust all the resources that are out there. So one of the things that I've proposed, we should make adoption more available to people. People shouldn't have to go overseas to different countries and adopt children. Over time, we've had couples who might have been homosexual who haven't been allowed to go out there and adopt. We've had many loving families that have had to go through rigorous red tape in order to adopt. And I think if we have a loving family here that wants to take care of a child, they should be able to adopt children. But they should also be allowed to adopt a child that's in the womb. If a mother in a poor neighborhood who's looking to make this decision knew that she had a family out there and knew that her child wasn't going to grow up in the system, which is a poor system for that matter, they might know that they have better options, that they can just send their child off with somebody else and work out a deal with them so that they can adopt in the womb.
Our guest during this portion of the program is Dale Kearns. Dale Kearns is a libertarian running for the U.S. Senate. WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lair. We only have about 5 minutes left, and I'm trying to get onto as many issues as I can. You also would propose, or have proposed, abolishing the Department of Education. Why, and how would children be educated?
Well, children currently aren't educated through the Department of Education. The Department of Education, we've only had it around since about 1980 under Jimmy Carter. And since then, education has gone south. We're not the greatest in the world when it comes to education anymore. And we educate our children like we're sending them off to manufacturing. It's more like an assembly line of education rather than critical thought. I think that we need to make education local again. Bring education back to the communities. Bring it back to the states. Get the federal government out of the process. If you want to go lobby your school board, that doesn't really help you right now. You have to go to Washington, D.C. and lobby for education. And I think that we should allow school boards, ultimately parents, to have the ultimate deciding factor on which books they get, which schools are, you know, might get the funding to have new schools, or you know, anything to do with education. Maybe you want to homeschool. I think that if we installed something more like a school choice program and allowed the states to decide, allowed the school boards to decide, and you could go lobby Mrs. Jones that you met at church or at the market the other day from the school board rather than Bob Casey in Washington, D.C., I think you'd have a better chance of impacting your child's education.
I want to move on to health care. You say that there's no incentive to lower prices when it comes to health care or lower cost because everything is covered by insurance, and what you propose is increasing competition to lower those prices. What do you mean by that? How would it work?
Well, I believe in the free market. And for one, we tie insurance to employers. I think that's wrong. I think what we need to do is allow people to decide for themselves what is the best insurance company to go with. If I call up my insurance company, I can't really change my plan. I can't do anything. I have to go through an employer. If we allow people to group purchase, whether it's with the AARP, the Boy Scouts, the Chamber of Commerce, they might be able to have better purchasing power and get a plan that's tailored to them. But ultimately, you should be able to call up your insurance company and say, I want pre-existing conditions. What does that cost? Look at a menu and know what your costs are. And you should be able to go across state lines. We want more and more insurance companies in the marketplace working for people rather than writing the laws that the government doesn't even read before they pass it. I think we need to get the government out of the business of healthcare as well, because when the government's in the business of healthcare, the insurance companies lobby them. The insurance companies write the bill, they fix the cost, and then the people are left out. About 50% of the country wants to do away with Obamacare. Well, Republicans were elected to go repeal and replace Obamacare or repeal Obamacare, and they didn't do that. So about 50% of the country is left out. They're left high and dry. If we went to my system, which is a free market system, you can just call up Blue Cross and Blue Shield or call up Aetna, and you can change your plan tomorrow because ultimately you have the purchasing power. You can't do that with the federal government.
I don't know whether those percentages, I assume that you're just throwing out percentages without, you know, saying that 50% of the country actually does like Obamacare or doesn't like Obamacare, because I think the figures are a little bit different than that.
Well, I'm going strictly off of the vote.
I know.
About 50% voted for Trump, and they voted for
right.
And actually, most of the country has voted for Republicans because they voted for the Republicans that are in the House. So Republicans represent more more of the country than Democrats do at this current point
yeah.
in time.
And I mention this just because I know someone will point it out afterwards that the 50% didn't vote for Trump or for Hillary Clinton. We only have about 45 seconds left. And Mr. Kearns, I always like to allow our candidates to leave a message with voters. What would yours be?
If you're tired of the political circus in Washington, D.C., you're tired with the two-party system, whether you're going to vote for a protest vote or whether you just believe in the message, believe in the message of liberty, believe in the message of freedom, that you should be able to do whatever you want on your property with your rights as long as you don't affect the property and rights of others, on November 6th, go vote for Dale Kearns. Go vote Libertarian. Vote for you. Put the power back in your hands, not in the hands of the two-party system.
Dale Kearns is the Libertarian candidate for the United States Senate from Pennsylvania. Mr. Kearns, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yes, thank you.
Coming up on Monday's program, you mentioned just a few minutes ago, we're going to be talking about open enrollment for the health insurance exchange that began yesterday. We'll be talking with Pennsylvania's Insurance Commissioner, Jessica Altman. Have a great weekend.